From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Chernia.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And one of the most significant conservation and ranching properties in the West, the Dugout Ranch, is adjacent to the Needles District of Canyonlands National Park and is the largest private inholding in Bears Ears National Monument.
That's right. Heidi Redd has spent her entire life living on the ranch and has chronicled that life in her new book, A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey, Stories from the Dugout Ranch. The book covers Heidi's tales of adventure, loss, and courage as she reflects on her transformation from a young ranch bride to a gritty cattle boss to a trailblazing conservation ambassador in a mission to save the land she loves.
So Heidi Redd will be joining us this morning live in the studio along with Sally Jewell, who served as the U.S. Secretary of the Interior under the Obama administration and wrote the foreword for the book. And also in the studio with us this morning, that's in the first part of the show.
Then in the second half of the show, we'll speak with David McGuire. He's the founder and director of Shark Stewards, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to save endangered sharks and rays from overfishing and the shark fin trade, which still exists, and also protect critical marine habitat through the establishment of marine protected areas. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the first part of the show is Heidi Redd and Secretary Sally Jewell, former U.S. Secretary of the Interior. And they're both here this morning to talk about, well, specifically Heidi Redd's book, A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey, Stories from the Dugout Ranch. Heidi, Sally, thank you for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
So, Heidi, let's start with you. I had a little bit of a faux pas in the introduction. I said you lived your entire life at Dugout Ranch, but there was a bit of a life before Dugout Ranch. So let's start there. Where were you before you came to Dugout Ranch?
Well, before Dugout Ranch, I was raised in Idaho and attended college, graduated from college from Utah State University.
Oh.
Where actually I met Robert Redd, and we eventually, after a lot of fun adventures together, settled at the Dugout Ranch.
And give us a little description. I know we talked about it briefly, of the location of Dugout Ranch down in the southeast part of the state, near the Needles District of the Canyonlands. But give us a sense of its acreage and its physical look.
Well, when I arrived at the Dugout Ranch, this was in the 60s, you traveled on a dirt road. It's a very isolated western ranch. So you traveled on a dirt road for 30 miles. You came to ranch headquarters, and you would hear this putt, 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 and you realize, what is that? Well, that's the generator, because there was no other power other than a generator for the ranch. No TV, no television. So it was a real outback place. And from the get-go, I must say, when you drop into the valley and you see the formations, it was the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for me from the get-go.
Yeah.
And Robert and I ran the ranch together for 23 years. And then as that relationship ended, I stayed and have been on the ranch for over a half a century running it. Mm.
So it was the landscape that first drew you to love the place, because
yes.
How did you find out about it, or what was the impetus to making you choose being there?
Well, I must say that from the minute I dropped down into Indian Creek, I felt this was my home. This was the place. And it really was. It's been the love of my life, and has treated me up and down, because Mother Nature treats you up and down. But the love has never wavered. It's not an easy life, and maybe that's the part I liked about it. It really did challenge me every day. But I always felt the embrace of those Red Rocks.
And this ranch was ostensibly a cattle ranch?
Correct. Uh-huh. It's Indian Creek Cattle Company, which I owned and ran and for all those years.
How many head of cattle?
Oh, a cowgirl never tells that.
No.
You're asking me how much money I made.
I did. Never did it tell. Okay, well, we'll leave that to our imagination.
Right.
But you said
it's a substantial for Utah cattle ranch. It's a substantial number, and the ranch encompasses 350,000 acres of government lease. That's the BLM, the Forest Service, and it used to also be the park, and 5,000 private acres, but. When I first arrived, the park had just barely been designated, and we owned private property within the park boundary and ran cattle in the park until 1976.
Oh, and then happened?
Then we were, it was a phase-out period. Mm-hmm. So after 76, we still owned the private property in Salt Creek until into almost the 80s, where the park didn't like the inholding. We tried to negotiate with them that we would never develop, we would never, you know, do anything, but they felt it in their best interest that they acquired it.
And I'm sorry, they meaning?
The National Park.
The National Park, mm-hmm. So they acquired that.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously it's unique perhaps from a geological setting, the environmental setting, no shortage of wildlife, plants and birds and other animals, etc. You had a whole host of, you know, a menagerie of wildlife there. Talk a little bit about that, experiences with that. Say, bear, mountain lions?
Bear. Had several fun times with bears. Oh, yeah. Mountain lion, of course, deer. And at that time, the deer population was horrendous. In one of our grazing areas, Big Basin, there were 6,000 that would winter in there, which was a lot.
Yeah, and put stress
on
the
sagebrush.
On the sagebrush. Uh-huh.
And of course, raccoon, now we have wild turkey, so there's a lot. Oh, and in the 90s, they planted elk on Elk Ridge, and so that was another species added.
They introduced elk to the
mm-hmm. And it's interesting because the area on the mountain that they planted elk to begin with was called Elk Ridge, but it was called Elk Ridge because there used to be a Texas cattle company that their brand was ELK.
So you have been there, you said, for how many years now at this point?
57.
57 years. So mm-hmm. obviously you have been through myriad changes there, and you've seen myriad changes there. And when we think of Bear's Ears, we almost think of fight for survival, right? A fight for saving the landscape. So what are some of those threats, and when were they the largest threats? When did they start to be introduced into
the largest
area?
Threat, well, of course, in the 80s when there was a knock on the door and this young man introduced himself. He was from the Department of Energy and was announcing, we want to do a nuclear waste repository here. Mm. And lucky you, because you will make a lot of money because they will buy our water and et cetera. And we were stunned and not exactly excited, to say the least. But the other pressure that was happening at that point was in Moab, Utah. This was a mining area in the whole San Juan County and Grand. Rio Alga mine had just closed. Miners were looking for work. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of excitement and about this possibility. And so Robert and I, being on the other side of that, we were very worried and did all we could in conversation to avert the problem. And I must say, the reason why we didn't end up with a nuclear waste repository was due to Governor Matheson at the time. He stepped up and said, not in my state. And that was the catalyst that really made it possible that we didn't have the... And that would have meant 700 ore trucks a day coming down a beautiful narrow canyon.
Wow. All right, so let me reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Heidi Redd. She is the author of the new book, A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey, Stories from the Dugout Ranch. And we're also honored to be have in the studio Sally Jewell. She's the former U.S. Secretary of the Interior under the Obama administration. Sally, let me bring you in on the conversation. How did you first meet Heidi and visit the Dugout Ranch?
It was June of 2016, and we were coming to Utah to learn more about these landscapes because there had been a push actually by the Utah delegation to create a public lands initiative, which was to protect what is now protected as Bears Ears National Monument. Mm-hmm. They would have preferred to do it legislatively, and so would we. And so we came out to learn about these landscapes. There was a bill that had been laboriously written with an awful lot of co-authors and input from five tribes of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. Organizations like the Nature Conservancy were involved. Black Diamond, in Utah, mm-hmm. A number of groups coming together working with the Utah delegation on legislation. So I came to listen and to hold open public meetings, the largest of which was about 1,500 people in a very hot day. But I stopped by the Dugout Ranch. Mm-hmm. Not a press trip, a trip to learn a little bit about Dugout, which, as Heidi mentioned, was an inholding in what became Bears Ears National Monument, to learn about the Nature Conservancy's work with Heidi and what was happening at the ranch. And it was a very memorable visit for me. So that was my first introduction to Heidi Redd. It certainly wasn't my first introduction to Canyon Country. I'd been here the first time in 1977. I know its extraordinary beauty. I understand what Heidi says about, it sort of getting into your life, your spirituality. It's all of those things, but it's so much more. And that's exactly what I began to learn at the Dugout Ranch and in my visit here.
Right, and when you say so much more, not only is it, its beauty with respect to its natural resources and environment, but it's culturally rich, too. Talk a little bit about how rich a land this is with respect to culture and artifacts.
There is no place that I have visited that was not yet protected, like as a national park, that needed more protection because of its importance to multiple native communities, present and, of course, ancient. Over 100,000 documented cultural sites exist within the boundaries of Bears Ears National Monument. And they are extraordinary cliff dwellings from the ancient Pueblo people, but they also are artifacts and seasonal camps from those tribes that, wintered or summered in different places, like the Ute people, the Navajo people, as well as multiple Pueblo people whose ancestors were on these landscapes. And their evidence is everywhere. And when we have roads and we have access, there is vulnerability, which is a huge reason why it was so important to protect these landscapes, because not only are they beautiful, not only are they accessible and continue to be for, sustainable and thoughtful cattle ranching like Heidi Redd has done through the Dugout Ranch, but also they are incredibly important from a sacred standpoint to many, many American Indians in this region.
And protection usually starts with partnership, right? So who has come to the table and helped with these partnerships and helped with these protections? Because I know Heidi, you speak to how the title of your book is called A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey, Stories from the Dugout Ranch, and your love of the history of the ranch, and then you got involved with the Nature Conservancy, and then you met Sally. So how does it that this all comes together to help lift up a place like Bears Ears National Park or your particular space there?
Well, first of all, I would say when the Needles District of the park was established, it was a very needed, although it was our grazing allotment and we lost some private land, it was to a very good cause because it started some conservation and some protections. And of course the conversation with being an inholding within the the Bears Ears, mm-hmm. was another step forward. The first step forward for protection came with partnering with the Nature Conservancy. And that came about in the 90s when there was a threat that is another long story, that the ranch would be sold. When I had a knock on the door from a fellow from Jackson Hole that was delighted that he might be able to create a golf course and condominiums. And my heart sank, but I knew this was no time to sit down and boo-hoo. It was time to get up and find an answer to this. So I contacted several people I knew that might have the funds, that might want a partner, but their sense of a partnership was development. And I also happened at the time to be on a board of the Canyonlands Field Institute. And while waiting for a meeting to start, there was a fellow by the name of Chris Monahue with the Nature Conservancy sitting behind talking to someone about how they had just purchased a ranch for conservation. And you know, I really felt like this was a spiritual intervention, like it was meant to happen. And so that was the start of the conversation to partner with the Nature Conservancy. And one of the most significant partnerships that the ranch could ever have made, because there is no discussion of any kind of development. It will stay in its natural state. And the other huge benefit to not only the Dugout Ranch, but to ranchers all over the world, is the Science Research Center that the TNC has started, the Nature Conservancy. And we study everything from grass to soils to cryptogamic soils. And now my son is heading the research on a special cattle that came in with the Spaniards, the Criollo, that are smaller, lighter on the land, graze further from water, not only eat grass but browse almost like a deer. And so it's an ongoing study. We have radio collars on them, and so we are discovering, are all these things we're anticipating that they do actually, does it happen? And so that might be the future animal that will sustain itself on drier lands.
So you mentioned, I believe, the Canyonlands Research Center that is there now.
Uh-huh.
Talk a little bit about its mission, maybe both of you, and can the public visit that research center?
The public is not invited to visit. Okay. I mean, they can make, but it is a working cattle ranch. It is a working science center, so we cannot have, you know, a constant inflow.
Right.
But I would like to toss this to Sally and let her explain that.
Yeah, well, let me just say I'm on the Global Board of the Nature Conservancy, mm-hmm. and as Heidi says in her book, which I encourage everybody to buy because it is a gripping read. It's full of amazing stories, but also it talks about the Nature Conservancy saying, we're not in the beauty business. We're in the business of understanding and protecting critical landscapes. So this is a landscape, both Heidi's fee simple land, the 5,000 or so acres, mm-hmm. and the BLM and Forest Service land that she grazes on, that has endemic species that is seeing lots of changes with climate, that really needs to be understood. So the Canyonlands Research Center Really, Heidi mentioned the Criollo cattle that they're experimenting with. They're also trying different cottonwood varieties to see how climate change is impacting the landscapes. They are bringing back the biocrust or the cryptobiotic crust, and they are educating a lot of young people. Utah State University was there when I was there just this last weekend. They have students from tribal communities and others come and support the research. There was a Youth Conservation Corps crew from the Hopi Nation working their tails off with Kristen Redd, who runs the Canyonlands Research Center, and they were playing beaver. They were redirecting stream flow to expand that stream flow the way it's naturally supposed to go so it doesn't go into canyons, which does happen when that water channelizes and flows. And from decade, I mean, 100 years ago, being overgrazed, it's changed the landscape, and they're trying to change it back. So what we learn as the Nature Conservancy from the Canyonlands Research Center and the Dugout Ranch will be applicable to ranching at a time of drought, not just in the United States, but around the world. So that's the key to the research part of it. And of course, you know, Matt Redd running the ranch itself, you know, how does a commercial cattle company continue to operate? And that's really important.
And I think a lot of times we need to understand our path forward in the future, we need to understand the past. And so you probably provide a lot of insight and information about what it has been like there through your probably just day-to-day research on the ranch. And now, how does that play into the path forward then? How, what are we looking at here as we move forward with Bear's Ears and this property? I know that we can love a place to death. There are a lot of climbers that are going there now. Mm. Can you speak to, you know, even people that want to preserve it, like what is happening in the future to help keep this place conserved?
Well, that's the other reason why the Bear's Ears was so important, is because of those issues. Mm-hmm. And yes, the climbers are impactful, very impactful, and in some ways they've changed the character of the canyon in the amount of traffic. And the nice thing, along with the research center, hand in hand, we have climbing stewards now that kind of base in and out of the ranch for supplies, but they are basically there to educate climbers about ethical climbing, not putting their pitons in a rock art face. Mm. And so that's been very, very helpful. And one of the things that, of course, I would really like to see is, instead of indiscriminate camping, to have designated camping, because that is going to be an issue. And Indian Creek alone is a absolute treasure trove of ancient rock art and dwellings. And to make sure that they're educated on those lines also is very important. And not just climbers, all of us. I don't think people usually go out to destroy something. They don't know that if you put your hand on a rock art, the oils and the acids from your hands is not good for it. So I would say the main problem, and it would be nice, you know, you can say law enforcement, really what you really need is education.
Right. There's inadvertent damage that could be done. But yet, there's still, well, is there still looting that goes on, too? Is that?
Well, just to add to what Heidi said, I mean, there's two issues. One's about access. So when the road was paved, you know, it brought more people in. So limiting access so that they can't ride roughshod over the land. And people don't necessarily mean to hurt the land, but they do it inadvertently.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll collect artifacts and deliver them to the BLM office, thinking they're doing something good, when in fact they're taking artifacts out of context, which is a huge problem.
So don't, if you see something on the ground, a pottery shard, don't pick it up.
Don't pick it up. And if you see something and you don't pick it up, you take a picture of it, remove the geotag before you put it on your website, because it's telling something, somebody who may want to loot, exactly where you saw that.
God, it's like citizen science in reverse.
Exactly.
So okay, so that's great. That's a great advice. And I will be aware of that as I head down to the Canyonlands next week. Don't leave it alone.
Leave it alone.
Last minute or so, Heidi, where can people go to get the book?
They can go to the King's English.
Oh, wonderful store.
Nature.org/Utah
has it.
Yes.
And do you have a website? Well, that's the website, I guess, to learn more
right.
about the book.
Yeah.
And now you're on a book tour?
We are on a book tour, and, you know, it's a very exciting, my love affair with the ranch and all those years, to me, when I started this book during the pandemic, you know, I thought, but I realize how important it is to record history.
Yeah. So. But you also write in a book that you get homesick quickly.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
you miss your home, as you should.
Yes.
It's unbelievably beautiful. And the photographs are incredible.
Well, I was
Claire
just going
to
say, as a photographer, it's illustrated beautifully. It takes you into the past. And like that's, I think my point before is the past can inform the future and how we treat things in the future. And I love looking back at your pictures and your stories. And you had mentioned earlier that it's not the easiest of lives. You were inducted into the Cowgirl Hall of Fame. I want to put that out there.
Right.
So you are this prolific person who has loved the land and been with the land and lived symbiotically with the land. So what I know that we have just a minute to go, but what is the lesson there for you that you really want those readers to absorb?
I would like them to take my love of a place and put it in their own lives, find their love of a place to protect. I don't care if it's their backyard, I don't care if it's a place they ski or they hike, mm-hmm. but take a love for a place and put your life on the line to protect it.
And Sally, what words can you leave us with about that, the protecting and preserving of land and your passion for that and where you see, we get excited about the hope of the future, but we are also live in reality of the future. So what would you say to give us a little bit of hope?
You know, I'm just gonna echo Heidi. First, if you read this book, you will recognize that not everyone can be a cowboy and a cowgirl. It is incredibly inspirational and unbelievably difficult. But we can all have a special place. We can all make it better, just like Heidi has been doing with the Dugout Ranch and the Nature Conservancy has been doing, and both of them in partnership with the U.S. government in this case, and with communities and the Access Fund, which is educating climbers. So find a place and make it better. And when you do work on lands, even if it's just picking up garbage or working on a trail, that place will never leave you.
Mm-hmm. Every acre matters in that sense.
Every acre matters.
The name of the book is A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey, Stories from the Dugout Ranch. The author is Heidi Redd. The foreword is written by Sally Jewell, former U.S. Secretary of the Interior under the Obama administration. Thank you so much for coming into the studio this morning and talking about that and sharing your story, Heidi. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was such a privilege to have you in our studios here at KPCW, and we appreciate you, and we hope everyone goes out there and has a chance to read your book. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
All right, let's take a break for an underwriter or two, and when we come back, we'll turn our attention to sharks. And let's talk with David McGuire, director and founder of Shark Stewards. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
And you are listening to This Green Earth. What a great interview that was, Chris.
Yes, absolutely. And now let's turn our attention to the sea world, the marine life. The
absolutely. Marine world. We go from the Dugout Ranch now to the oceans. And very important research that is being done through Shark Stewards. We have David McGuire, who is the founder and director of Shark Stewards, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to save endangered sharks and rays from overfishing and the shark fin trade and protect critical marine habitat through the establishment of marine protected areas. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Fantastic. Well, I want to get started. When was Seagrass Day? Because I want to talk about that
yeah.
for a second. I think there was a month or that we celebrate?
Yes, it
deserves a whole month. Yes.
Well, actually, this month, sorry, is International Seagrass Month in recognition of this important flowering plant that is little known or little considered, but has overwhelming significance relative to its visual presence or size.
Yeah, and I want to start there because I'm interested to know how things play into an ecosystem, because we talk about from the very, very tiniest microscopic organism to a shark, which obviously is hard to miss, and a large species. Tell us how seagrass plays into this ecosystem and what it means for our oceans.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny path for me as a shark conservation group, but our mission is to protect sharks and save sharks and critical marine habitat. And we often think about sharks and the place they live as coral reefs or kelp beds or offshore pelagic ecosystems, but we tend not to be as aware of estuarine or wetlands or seagrass beds and sharks. So we got involved in the San Francisco Bay, which of course is the largest estuary in North America on the West Coast, mm-hmm. and a significant source of many species, including humans, that rely on the bay for sustenance and for a lot of other services, including climate change mitigation. We discovered the importance of seagrass beds to bat rays and hound sharks, particularly leopard sharks, which were a beautiful little shark that is present along the West Coast from Canada down to Mexico, and particularly a California shark. And so I learned about seagrass beds through a colleague, Dr. Kathy Boyer, at the Esperon Ocean Science Center at the University, or San Francisco State University here on the Bay. And I learned that there's an alarming decline of seagrasses globally. We've lost about 20% of the seagrass beds since humans, that is almost 30% through direct human impacts like dredging and pollution and general disregard. And yet seagrass beds have a much more significant impact on climate mitigation. They can absorb 10 to 18% of the ocean's carbons each year, much more significant capturing carbon than forests, for example. And yet we tend not to consider these undersea meadows that provided services not only to sharks, but also to food that people rely on, like oysters and salmon and crabs, which use seagrasses as refuge and also a source of foraging habitat.
Right. So I like the way the seagrass is described as seagrass meadows. That's a good way for us landlubbers to kind of get the relationship between the importance of seagrass is. It's like the above water version or below water version of a meadow, and like you say, it serves as a nursery for all types of marine life, but including sharks or different species of sharks. So you kind of alluded to some of the threats. Obviously, there's just direct human threats from man with respect to dredging or water pollution. What role is climate change and a warmer world and warmer oceans playing in seagrass health?
Yeah, great question. Seagrasses are a flowering plant, you know, so they're not an algae like our giant kelp beds. And so they have chlorophyll like a tree. Mm. And if they can get overheated from warm sea surface temperature. So for the first time that I know of, there's actually been an epidemic of seagrass bleaching, somewhat akin to coral bleaching, although a different mechanism. Coral has a symbiotic invertebrate, a dinoflagellate, that lives in it, that gives it its color and leaves when it's the water is too hot, leaving the coral polyp. In this case, this is actual, just, I think, more direct damage. And we've seen significant bleaching of our seagrass bed since we had this large marine heat wave in the late 2000s, or sorry, yeah, 2015 to 2018, we had a significant bleaching event. And then we've had warmer sea surface temperatures off the West Coast, and it's causing damage to these seabeds in some of our national estuarine habitat, our national seashore at Point Reyes, in some of the estuaries along the Central Coast, where there were relatively large and intact seagrass beds. So this is not damage from siltation, from development, for example, or dredging has a huge impact directly on seagrass beds. Anchoring also causes a lot of damage when boats are anchoring or dragging their anchors, or even boats striking bottoms. In this case, this is a climate change impact. And ironically, there's a study that came out 2 years ago that indicates seagrass beds can actually mitigate the impacts of climate change. It can actually lower pH or reduce the impacts of ocean acidification, which has serious impacts or grave damage to formation of plankton or reefs and other calcium requiring organisms.
And what, and seagrass in general, I'm assuming, presents itself or expresses itself across all latitudes of the planet?
Yeah, there are about 70 species, and they live on every continent except for Antarctica. Hmm. And they provide a lot of important services for humans. I think we don't consider them as much as native peoples once did, but they were also used for habitation, building structures, weaving baskets. So there is a structural integrity to the seagrass that can be used for other purposes than just the value of it alive. And you know, the meadow metaphor, I had to say just firsthand, you can't really see them in the San Francisco Bay. Mm-hmm. It's like trying to swim in a cup of coffee. You really can't see very well because of all the sediments. But out in the outer coast, they're this brilliant, beautiful green, and they're flowing like less like a tree in the wind, more mm-hmm. like a grass on a prairie, flowing in the currents. And there's this, especially Zostera marina, the surf grass has this really bright, fluorescent, almost green color that's just dynamic and beautiful.
Are there efforts afoot to both protect and preserve seagrass habitat? And is it possible to do some form of replanting if in damaged areas?
Yes, there is. Because it is a flowering plant and it actually has a root-like structure, it's very easy actually to replant seagrass beds. And there are significant restoration efforts going on here on the West Coast, in the San Francisco Bay, actually, and Dr. Boyer has done quite a bit of experimentation also, including not only seagrass beds, but also seeding native oysters, which also have potential mitigation impacts for acidification. And so you're seeing actually a better and faster restoration when you have plants and animals that traditionally have lived together rather than just trying to plant a monoculture like we would with a pine forest, for example. Down in Los Angeles, there have been some successful restoration efforts in Marina del Rey. In San Diego, the same. There's been some work in Mexico and the Baja Peninsula. I'm not as familiar with work on the West Coast. I know there has been significant restoration in the Chesapeake Bay, which is also an important wetland and estuary. And then in Florida, in the U.S., is probably our largest intact seagrass beds, but really with one of the hugest human impacts and risks due to boating activity and, you know, that huge heat wave that affected many animals, including manatees and sea turtles, just last year. But the hopeful thing is it's actually really easy. And kind of the beauty is they also have rhizomes, sort of like strawberries, where the plants are interconnected to each other, which provides a stability to the benthic or the bottom system. So it can actually protect against erosion, but it also can allow them to recover if we allow it. So if there is an area that's been dredged or gets impacted by a boat, it actually, the ones around it can fill in the gap. So it is, seagrasses are incredibly resilient. And you know, going back to sharks, as we're a shark conservation group, they provide so much food. There was an estimate that a single acre can support 40,000 fish and 50 million invertebrates, like lobsters and shrimp and crabs. And here on the West Coast, where the last really significant commercial fishery is the Dungeness crab fishery. In the San Francisco Bay, it's sort of our turkey. For Thanksgiving, people eat Dungeness crab. And the larvae preferentially settle and grow in seagrass meadows. So these seagrasses are actually supporting a $1 million industry, a fishery. And so losing that, you lose your larvae and you lose your fishermen.
We are speaking with David McGuire, who is the founder and director of Shark Stewards, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to save endangered sharks and rays from overfishing and the shark fin trade. And we are talking about seagrasses now, but and how they kind of play into our world of the ocean and different species, but also the main, I guess, mission that you have is shark preservation. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this new film that you have, this documentary that's about sharks, about cultural and traditional conservation. We were just speaking a lot about conservation and cultural aspects of conservation. So can you take me a little bit through this documentary and why it's so important to the education on sharks?
Yes, thank you. A lot of our work at Shark Stewards is to communicate risks, but also solutions to sharks and ocean health, really, because it's all connected. I mean, we just saw that with seagrasses and invertebrates and fish and sharks are interconnected. I was fortunate enough to work in Hawaii during COVID because I couldn't work in Southeast Asia and couldn't travel like many of us where we're working in reef restoration and shark protecting sharks through trade, particularly shark fin. So I was living in Kona, and I've had quite a bit of experience with Polynesian culture. And so we made a film called Kahumano, which are the shark guardians, the traditional shark savers, if you will, or protectors of the shark. And I learned through native kumus or teachers the significance of sharks to Polynesian peoples, particularly Hawaiians, and that they have a reverence for sharks that translates to protection because they believe that many of the families believe that sharks are their guardian spirit and even their ancestors, so that these sharks are sacred to them, and they protect sharks, and they're not afraid of sharks. They don't have all the negative connotations that our cultures or other cultures tend to have, that sharks are man-eaters or are cold-blooded killers and the Jaws effect. But sharks, they recognize, are important to the health and benefit of the ocean ecosystems, and that we can coexist with sharks. So we made a film called Kahumano that actually interviews this one kumu, Maika Kamohoali'i, who has the shark god name. Kamohoali'i was Madame Pele's brother, and Pele is the goddess of the volcano, which is another beautiful metaphor connecting the land, the island, and in this case, the Aina, to the sea, to the Manoa, that is. So the Maika talks about the significance to sharks and also shares it through his the culture of dance and chant, which is featured in the film. And I guess we wanted to tell a story of hope and of triumph and of an example, because Hawaii is the only place in the United States you cannot kill a shark. They are protected commercially from commercial fishing, they are protected from recreational fishing, and they were the first state to ban the sale and trade of shark fins. So having worked in all of that legislation and regulation, we wanted to share the hard work done by the people of Hawaii and share that elsewhere to Pacific Fisheries Management, to Atlantic Tuna Fisheries, because Hawaii also was the first to change out harmful fishing gear that kills thousands, if not millions, of sharks accidentally or incidentally through bycatch. So the film is an advocacy film. We were using it at a tuna commission meeting in Los Angeles next month to try to urge them to follow the kahumanu and change out gear that's harmful not only to sharks but to marine mammals and other species in the ocean.
Well, we've got a few more minutes. Can you give us an update on the shark fin industry, the ongoing challenge to try to change behaviors and attitudes towards this, these are my words, this myth that shark fins are supposed to have some beneficial effects to our to us and such, or the cultural aspects of shark fin and the damage that that behavior is having on the sharks' populations?
Yeah, well, I guess we need to first try to understand the cultural beliefs behind it, and it's primarily Chinese, and it's associated with the Emperor Sung 1,000 years ago, and it really is a symbol of honor and face and cachet, if you will, prestige. And it's a dish that's very expensive and is served at banquets and weddings and occasions of high honor, Chinese New Year. And what happened is the emperors and the nobility turned into a huge middle class, or at least that belief system and consumption changed from a few emperors and nobility to millions of middle class consumers and upper middle class in China, when China went from communism to social capitalism. So there's a tremendous amount of wealth, and this old or these antique beliefs and associations unfortunately translated into a modern time, which led to a gold rush on the ocean for shark fins. And as many as 70 to 100 million sharks are being killed for their fins. In the U.S., we started 15 years ago in Hawaii and California and Washington, Oregon, and now President Biden signed the Shark Fin Sales Elimination Act in 2023. So the U.S. Prohibits sale, regulation, and consumption. And we did that with the help of our Chinese-American citizens, people who cared, people who realized that the consumption of a luxury dish that's killing too many animals is not beneficial, it's not healthy, and it's not good for anyone. So we're producing short video in Chinese. We have a chapter in Shenzhen, China, which is akin to sort of a Silicon Valley in Eastern China, and hoping to make people aware that it's not only unhealthy for the environment, because we need sharks. Sharks are important in their role as apex predators regulating the food chains, but also it's not healthy for humans because it has mercury and other organic toxins that bioaccumulate in shark. So education is key, but intervention is critical. There's so much value on the shark fin that we've got to regulate the trade. We've got to protect endangered sharks because as long as there's demand, the bad guys, the poachers, will still continue to provide the trade. And so there's a lot of work to be done, but the EU is considering a shark fin trade ban. Particularly Spain is the largest shark fishing nation. The UK has passed a similar law. Canada actually led the global shark fin trade ban movement as a nation, even though we started here in the US about 10 years earlier. And so there is hope. there's increasing awareness, and really we need to be aware that we're just overfishing sharks in general too much, and that we need to reduce overfishing and hopefully follow the path of the Kahumano and other cultures, Native Americans here on the West Coast, that can coexist and actually recognize that sharks, like seagrasses, have a greater importance than just one animal. They play a much larger impact on the ecosystems that they inhabit.
And so awareness and education is really what your organization does. And can you tell us where people can find you and learn more about the sharks and also seagrass and how they can maybe get involved?
Yeah, you can reach us at sharkstewards.org. There's our news. We have the Seagrass Month blog on there if you want to read the connection between climate, seagrasses, and sharks. Of course, we're on social media, Facebook. We don't do too much TikTok, but we're on Instagram, Shark Good. Stewards. And people can go to our website and subscribe to our newsletter. There are a lot of volunteer opportunities. We have volunteers all over the planet who work where they are to either raise awareness or directly impact trade or just generating ocean love. We also have a GoFundMe right now to try to get Kahumano out to the United Nations, to take it to these venues. The film is done, but we really need to get the film campaigned and to get it out there to as many people who can make an influence and make decisions on reducing overfishing of sharks and follow Hawaii's example, protecting habitat as well as sharks.
And it is screening at the Dana Point Film Festival on May 4th. If people want to take a look at that, that is at sharkstewards.org. David, thank you so much for joining us this morning.